Portfolio Doctors are Dan Osgood and Stephen Bick, who are investment advisor representatives of their respective registered investment advisor firms, ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management Company LLC. The opinions expressed by the Portfolio Doctors and guests on this radio show are their own and do not reflect the opinions of this radio station. All statements and opinions expressed are based upon information considered reliable, although it should not be relied upon as such. Any statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Moreover, no listener should assume that any discussions or information presented serves as the recipient of or a substitute for personalized advice from ACAS LLC, Cottingham Management LLC, or from any other investment professional and is not intended as an offer of solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. ACAS LLC and Cottingham Management LLC are not law or accounting firms, and no portion of this presentation should be interpreted as legal, accounting, or tax advice. The information expressed does not take into account your specific situation or objectives and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for any listener. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified tax, legal, or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation.
You're listening to the Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. Your financial future depends on making sound investment decisions. Make sure you get accurate information and a weekly checkup from a source you can trust, Portfolio Doctors. Now, live in studio, here's Dan Osgood and Steve Bick, the Portfolio Doctors.
Welcome to the Portfolio Doctors radio show. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a beautiful day, and we're hoping everyone's enjoying their week. It's winding down. Very quick recap, the markets. It seems like this week some of the panic maybe has settled down. A little less concern over the correction. I even saw the headline saying the correction is over.
Yeah, that was quick, huh?
Yeah.
You don't need much of a correction when you have a Fed that just keeps deciding to put money into an economy.
Well, I like that they're telling us when the corrections are starting and when they're ending. That makes everything much easier.
Absolutely. Now we know. Now we can start buying again.
Yes.
In fact, darn it, we didn't get in during the correction.
Yeah. You know.
That was a big buying opportunity, that 3.5% move in January.
Right. Big moves. Yeah. Earlier this week, I believe, was it Monday or Tuesday morning, I guess, Janet Yellen came out and made her first official public appearance as the new Fed chairperson. And basically, she came out and emphasized the continuity in the Fed's policy strategy, saying she strongly supports the approach of her predecessor, Ben Bernanke.
Well, that's a big surprise, huh?
Yeah, that I found that to be rather humorous, that the market rallied so strongly that day. There shouldn't have been a single surprise to anyone. Maybe there's always that what-if scenario.
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
But the reality is everybody knew. Her track record is pretty proven. She has been basically broadcasting how she's going to act before she even took this position, saying that if unemployment is at this number, then we'll consider doing things. If inflation is at this number, then we'll consider doing things. And she basically came out and said the same thing.
Yeah, no, exactly right. I mean, but actually, the one part of that whole testimony that really interested me the most was that she didn't say that we're going to stop reducing our buy-ins. She said we'll continue to cut back or scale back on our purchases, our monthly purchases through the year.
So how often does the Fed meet typically? Is
most
it a
months.
Quarterly or
no,
every
it's,
month?
It's most months. There's a couple of months that they don't. I think it's like 8 or 9 times a year they meet.
Because I know I've seen people projecting that by August, September, October, somewhere in there, they're expecting the Fed funding will be entirely gone.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Another, you know, 5 or 6 cuts and there you go.
And they're gone. Because what are we at now? It went from 85 to 75 to 65 now.
Right. So 6 more cuts, you're done.
For some reason, I would be shocked, I think, if they do away with it in its entirety by year end.
I would be as well. And certainly if they do, I'll be incredibly surprised if the market's continuing to rally on that.
Right.
That's, you know, it's been stimulated and supported by the Fed, and to pull back the entire $65 billion a month, I just don't see that happening.
Right, because every time they talk and they do that, you see a dip in the market. And there's definitely some panic, even though, like the unemployment report, which typically would be good news, that it's improving, but not for the right reasons, as we've talked in the past. As people are falling off the long-term benefits, they're disappearing from the numbers.
Well, that's exactly right. And then the other thing that she said, which was a little bit counterintuitive, was she said, okay, we're going to continue to reduce our spending or our buy-in, but we're also going to lower the unemployment target. Whereas Bernanke had said at 6.5% or lower, we've met our unemployment target. And now she's saying, well, 6.5% may not be the correct number. Maybe we need to lower it a bit more because, as you've correctly said, people are just falling off the bottom back end of the stimulus packages and not getting their unemployment benefits, so then they're not counted. So maybe she's recognizing that to some degree and saying that we'll continue to stimulate the economy even if unemployment falls below 6.5%.
Right.
But then on the other side of the coin, she's saying, oh, and we're going to continue to cut. So, I mean, what are you doing? Are you going to cut or are you going to stimulate?
So maybe that's just drawing a line in the sand saying we're not going to say, because they have used 6.5% in the past.
Correct.
As a number, and they're very close to that now.
6.6, you're basically on the number.
Right. So if the next number comes out, I think maybe, this is just a guess, but maybe it's, if we hit that number, we don't want to be forced to just stop funding 100% altogether.
No, certainly.
And we want to have the freedom to stop it altogether and continue funding it, $45 billion or whatever the
numbers
are.
Right, no, exactly right. And I think at that point they might even start to stimulate. Could you imagine if there's a sudden spike in unemployment? I think they're going to have to step on the accelerator. And also, I just don't see all this talk about the economy's coming back. There's the pickup in business. Everything's looking a lot better. You know, they've done their job. Now's the time to get out. They've done a job. I don't think they did their job. I think their job was to step out of the market back in about 2009, but that's just me. So if they had done that, the market wouldn't be at whatever it is. I don't even know where the S&P's at, like 1,800 or so. I mean, we would probably have an S&P at around 1,200, which would be a more normal market.
Right.
It would be a more normal recovery. We wouldn't have this fictitious increase in net wealth. And I think later on, we're also going to talk about this big discrepancy between the haves and have nots.
Right.
But I mean, that's just getting wider and wider. I think they've created something like $30 or $40 trillion in increased wealth over the last 3 or 4 years to the U.S. Consumer.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that's basically been pushed towards the high net worth people because they're the ones that have benefited because they're in the market.
Right. The ultra wealthy are getting wealthier and everyone else is status quo or in the lesser position now.
Correct. So, I mean, really, have they done their job? No. Unemployment's still 6.6. This is back since 2009. I mean, my goodness, how many years is that? 5 years. And we've still got unemployment at 6.6. But we've got a massive deficit. We've got a massive, I think, what's the deficit projected to be next year? $500 billion?
$514 billion.
Which is a massive improvement on $1.4 trillion, which it was at the peak. But it's still, when you think about, I remember back in the good old days of Clinton and that, and there was, Clinton managed to balance the budget and all of it. But when Bush came along and they had a budget deficit of $100 billion, everyone was in uproar.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are.
And we're at 500, five times.
Back down from $1.4
trillion. Right.
It's just unbelievable. I mean, how the heck do we even, that's just unconceivable.
Do you think that's similar to the gas price games that we've seen where they run them up to $4, $4.50 a share? So that when it gets down to the current levels of 350, 360, 370, you think, oh, that's not so bad.
Yeah, exactly. Bargain.
Is that what they're doing? They ran it all the way up to $1 trillion,
yeah,
and now they've gotten it down to $500 billion. So people are going, oh, that's not so bad.
Well, the interesting part, though, when you run it up to 1.4, right, that was a big stimulant for unemployment. It brought it down pretty quickly because that meant the government was just sucking up people left and right to do goodness knows what.
Right.
But now they're going the other way. They're trying to cut government to try and get this balanced budget. And so now it's really putting a damper on the whole trying to repair the unemployment numbers.
Right. Well, and that all falls to what? The sequester?
Yeah.
Where they were doing all the government cuts, which people have made such a big deal over that. And the reality is that's the same thing a big corporation would do. If they're having difficulties, they're going to look for ways to trim the fat.
Right.
And unfortunately, that means people get laid off. And you make cuts wherever is deemed necessary. That's all the sequester has done.
Right. No, exactly right.
So if anyone who's listening was affected by that, I'm sorry. That's awful. I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But the reality is that it's probably been one of the better things that's happened over the last 5, 10 years.
I agree, actually. You know, you're right. It did impact certain people and will impact more, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just continue to print money.
Right.
And I mean, it sort of comes back to the other side, maybe that when the market rallied, it might not have necessarily been all Yellen. It could potentially have also been that whole discussion that they were having at the same time about the budget ceiling or the
right.
You know.
Yeah, that the market did see some headwind removed the Republicans basically caved in to President Obama's demands that they're going to need to put legislation through that allows lifting of the debt ceiling or an increase.
But it wasn't just an increase. It was just taking away the need for a debt ceiling.
Well, that's my question is, who that's listening today would like a Visa card with no credit limit attached to it? Just feel free to spend.
Yeah.
Because that's virtually what our leaders in Washington have just given themselves.
It's just unbelievable.
It's pretty nice that they're allowed to trade on inside information, which no one else in the world is.
Right.
Now they have an unlimited credit limit credit card. It seems like it's a pretty good gig to be in Washington. Now we're understanding why they're campaigning 100% of the time and not paying attention to doing their job.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And the other side of it, though, you think about it, I mean, it just sort of smacks of Weimar Republic type stuff. You can print as much money as you want. Where's the control? Who's looking over their shoulders saying, hold on, guys, you know, spending an extra few trillion a year is not going to benefit any of us. You're going to have to pay the piper eventually. Having no limit,
right?
It's just absolutely crazy. You need to have some kind of a control in place. Otherwise, like you say, you're just a kid in a candy store. Hey, let's go and buy, you know, let's buy 40 new aircraft carriers. You know, well, they're only a few hundred billion apiece, whatever.
Right.
You know.
Let's build 10 of them.
Yeah.
It's job creation.
Yeah. Well, you would think,
so
but they'll probably have
some
South
degree.
Koreans build them. I mean, you know, it's stuff like that that just drives me crazy.
Right.
How can you have no controls, no balances, no... I mean, you and I are both under the guise of either the SEC or some kind of a regulatory body out there. And I mean, I know from my standpoint, I have to be audited. I have to have a spot check every year. They've got to come in and do a spot examination. I've got to report to the Department of Corporations in California. I've got to report to FINRA. I've got to do. I mean, it's like you're under the spotlight and being shone straight at you, and you've got to abide. And there's all these counter checks and balances to try and keep you in place and do the right thing. And yet they've now gone ahead and they can do whatever the heck they want.
Right. There's no one looking after the people that are creating these rules and regulations that everybody else has to follow.
Yeah. It's our money.
Yeah.
So it's your and my money. It's our taxpayer money that they're now allowed to spend as much money as they want.
And when they run out, they'll just increase taxes a little more like they've been doing the last few years.
Well, what they're going to do is they're basically buying votes, aren't they? Because you can go out there and you can just create another social program to buy yourself another 10 or 20 million votes. I just don't see the Republicans with a chance of ever getting back in at this point.
Yeah, it seems like with the next election, that'll be kind of the key one. If one of these candidates doesn't step up, it could be a very different America 5, 10 years.
It's already
from now.
A very different America.
It is. And I understand things evolve. For a reason, better or worse, you never know until you see how it plays out. But
well, certainly when we come back, I mean, we must chat about just how much this playing field has evolved, because I think that's definitely a topic we should address when we get back.
Okay. I'll be right back. Welcome back. You are listening to the Portfolio Doctors radio show on ESPN 1700. If there's anything we talk about, something that piques your interest, something that just makes you think of a question, feel free to reach out to us. You can reach Steve at steve@theportfoliodoctors.com, or you can reach me, dan@theportfoliodoctors.com, or you can reach out to us via phone. That is 858-764-7250. Once again, that's 858-764-7250. We've been talking about kind of the government running wild and cashing our checks.
Unbelievable.
And no one keeping an eye on them.
That's exactly right.
I came across a pretty interesting an article where there's a gentleman who's done pretty substantial research into the differences between people that are wealthy and people that are poor,
right,
and the different habits. And it was, some of it made sense, but others, it was a little bit eye-opening. And this guy, his name's Tom Corley. He spent more than 5 years observing more than 350 different rich and poor people, how they live, work, sleep, everything. And he wrote a book, Rich Habits, The Daily Success Habits of Wealthy Individuals. And in his research, he defined wealthy as a family earning $160,000 or more a year. It's not clearly defined, but $160,000 in annual income. Okay. So I'm assuming whether it's an individual or joint income, that still classifies as being pretty wealthy in this day and age. And then holding $3.2 million in assets. So that's a much bigger number.
That side of it is wealthy.
Definitely. Even in California, where houses are at the upper end of the range of houses across the country, $3.2 million is very substantial. So that definitely qualifies in my book as being wealthy people. And then poor was defined as income under $30,000 a year and less than $5,000 in assets.
Ouch. Yeah, the asset side for sure.
So in both of those, I mean, $30,000 here in Southern California, that can be pretty challenging to just live off of that income.
I did that once.
Yeah.
But I was single and sleeping on the floor in a friend's house. Oh, and suddenly I had cash from everywhere. But if you switch up all the bills, it's quite amazing what you can do.
You were probably wealthier then than at any other point in your life, weren't you?
I am now for sure.
So with that, I thought just reading through there, those parameters fit pretty well to cover both ends of the spectrum. And basically what he found out, and these are good tips to kind of try to follow, and it will make you more productive, and all of a sudden things will start happening. The first thing, wealthy people tend to be early risers.
Well, I'm up 5 a.m. I just can't sleep. It's one of those things you wake up and you just your brain's working on what you need to do already.
You've got too many things going on.
Yeah.
44% of the people wake up at least three hours before their 9-to-5 job.
There you go.
And in those hours, they tend to focus on self-improvement, like reading educational material, trade journals, industry blogs, things related to their business. They'll also squeeze in a workout, some form of exercise, treadmill, go for a jog, bike ride, something simple. And typically, exercise, and I've done this where I've gotten up at 5 and exercised for an hour, and I do tend to be much more productive and have more energy throughout the day than the days that I maybe sleep that extra hour and get up and just get into my day. The next common trait was keep a running list of tasks. You always hear people talking about writing out a list and then checking them off, and that is a very productive way to organize and manage a day's worth of activities.
Yeah, you've got to do that. I do that all the time.
Yeah.
My biggest issue is some weeks when you work like crazy all week and you're knocking stuff off your list and you get to the end of the week, and I always spend at least half an hour on Friday afternoon writing down what has to be done next week, and then the list's already still longer than what you started with.
That's great. We're halfway through the week. You're adding more things than you're subtracting.
Exactly.
I've done that. My difficulty is, as I'm compiling this list and work is piling up, finding that list to know if I'm checking things off.
Yeah, there you go.
the next thing, no long lunches.
No.
Taking a long leisurely lunch isn't a wealthy habit. About 55% of the wealthy people network or wheel and deal between bites. So go out, have a business-related luncheon or meeting, or go out and meet with other people that might be a referral source, someone that has a similar business that may come across people that could work well with the business you're conducting.
Don't even have that, I mean, a lot of times I'll just spend my lunch reading and trying to catch up on industry journals or the market or ideas and things like that.
Doing a little more of the morning
stuff. So, exactly.
Which definitely, that's not time wasted.
Right.
Because you do need to take a break and eat.
Correct.
It's very important. Another one, calorie counting.
Wealthy, I don't do that.
Wealthy people are big calorie counters.
That's my problem now. You see, that's my problem there now.
Need to start counting calories.
Yeah, exactly.
And part of this goes along with wealthy people tend to be healthy people, and because being healthy is more about making money. If you're healthy, you have fewer sick days, which means you're more productive. You're in the office, which generally is making you more money.
Yeah.
The second to last common trait is no gossiping.
No.
Who here hasn't stood in the corner chatting with the coworker and next thing you know, a half hour has gone by. You haven't accomplished anything, but you're up to date on all the news in the office.
I can't remember doing that in decades.
Well, it's been a while.
It's quite hard because it's only me, myself, and I. So I could have a conversation with myself.
You need to get a water cooler and just jump back and forth. Put a hat on top and put a hat on one side. And you can do that.
Oh, man. Yes, I don't do that. That's for sure.
And I think people that are self-employed, or like a sole proprietor, right? That one's not going to fit. But this is even for people in like a corporate environment where that tends to happen. There's a lot of people that just want to chit chat about other people in the office or their Aunt Edna or whatever it is. And you need to kind of steer away from that. And that will allow you to be more productive, which if you're in that corporate environment, that'll get recognized if you're being more productive, and you'll work your way up the ladder pretty quickly. And then the last one, and this one I could see being a big challenge for all levels of the playing field, is limited internet.
Well, I'm on that all day long because that's my business.
Well, that I think business-related internet is very different. This is, at the end of the day, how do you unwind? Do you head to the bar? Do you veg out in front of the TV? Most wealthy folks generally network, volunteer, or socialize in some sense. And according to Mr. Corley's research, the majority of people that are struggling with their finances tend to spend more than an hour on recreational internet use per day, and were twice as likely to hop on Facebook every single day.
Boy, Facebook, yeah, I didn't do that.
Facebook. I have numerous friends that, I mean, we'll be out doing things. They'll take a quick picture with their cell phone, and they're updating it. Hey, I'm over at the beach.
What a waste of time, of everyone's time, even the people that read it on the other side.
Oh, yeah. Well, because those same people are, their phone's beeping all the time, and they're always checking, oh, so-and-so posted a message on Facebook.
Well, whatever happened to just sitting and having a conversation with the person at the table with you?
Right.
It drives me crazy.
I've seen this quite a bit lately, which I found pretty interesting. There are people that are having no electronic device periods of time in every day with their families and coworkers, where you can't have your cell phone, you can't have your iPod or whatever device you have, which is an attempt at bringing back to the whole personal conversation and, hey, how was your day kind of things. I remember doing that with my family when I was young, and I have great memories of many of those conversations.
No, you got to do that. I agree. That's what we do in our family as well. So, but, you know, based on those things, that's very interesting. But another thing just that sort of goes a little bit with that is showing just exactly, and I'm struggling now, of course, to find my little article. But there was an article I read that said 85 people in the globe. Oh, here we go. 85 people. This is just 85. Not 85,000, just 85 people.
Okay.
The top 85 people.
So like all the guys
like
in the men's
Warren
room at a
Buffett.
Charger game at one time.
Yeah, exactly. No, but this is 80, not necessarily guys, just people,
okay.
Right? But these 85 wealthiest people in the world own almost 50% of the world's wealth.
50%.
So 85 people. You want to talk about them and us? That's them.
That's them.
They own 85%, at least
50%,
just under, actually, it's 46, of the total world's wealth.
Wow. So that's the Bill Gates, the Warren Buffetts.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
So is that all the billionaires in
the
world?
Well, that must be.
How many? I don't know how many billionaires there are. That list seems to change every year.
Yeah.
Most years it's increasing, but
yeah. I mean, if you're not a billionaire, you're definitely not part of this club, I don't think. But then, interesting. So the next thing that was really interesting was, how much do you have to earn per year to be in the top 1% of the world's richest? Now, this is the world, remember? And I know when we talked about it, what did you say it was like?
I would guess, $5 million a year?
Right, Well, it turns out, because we're talking about the world now, it's only $34,000 a year.
$34,000. That's a little bit different.
Yeah, to be in the top 1% of the world.
So if you're taking into account the world, there's a lot of places where people don't earn any income whatsoever.
And, India and places like this. To be in the top half of the global population, in terms of income each year, you only need to earn $1,200 a year.
$1,200, not $12,000.
No, $1,200. So in other words, most people that I know will earn that within 3 days.
Okay.
less, probably one. And here, this is for the whole year. So that's just crazy. And then to be in the top 1%, 0.1%, so not even 1%, 0.1%.
So 0.1%.
0.1% requires annual income of only $70,000.
$70,000.
So, I mean, it just shows you, while what we're talking about in America is just so different once you leave the rest, leave the shores.
Right.
And particularly, I mean, America, Europe, Japan, those, you know, and you leave there and you, let's say, you go into the rural Africa or rural Asia, or, I mean, these people just earn nothing. Their subsistence is just, you know, you see these advertisements on TV for just put a tap into a village and everyone's happy.
Right. Yeah, because in the village,
there's nothing
real need for income.
No.
They're living off the land.
Well, I don't know. You might want some shoes and you might want to, you know, have a bit of more education. But yeah, all it is if you farm and you have a bad year, an arid year, you the whole village is wiped out.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just really brings home how fortunate we are here. And while we're talking about all these things and how to make money and all of that, sometimes we just have to put it into perspective with what's going on out there.
Focus on how it is all around the world.
But what it also shows is that it's not going to take a lot for the rest of the world just has to earn $2,000 a year. And there's a massive swelling of wealth created around the globe. And that's why people say you need to have less of a divide between the haves and have-nots. Because if you have a less of a divide, more money is distributed amongst more people. Imagine taking these people that are earning $1,200 a year and giving them $5,000 a year.
Right.
That extra $4,000 is going to be spent.
Well, that's we've talked about this before, but this whole QE, all this bond buying, if they would have taken those same dollars and just distributed them among every U.S. citizen, our economy would be booming right now.
Correct.
Because that money guaranteed 99% of that would have been spent.
Right.
And all that's going to do is drive business.
Exactly. So these guys, now you're only paying them, they're only getting $4,000 more a year, but they're going to buy shoes, they're going to buy clothes, they're going to buy pots and pans, they're going to buy, you know, goodness knows, maybe a bicycle, or if they could maybe afford a car, I don't know, as a group. Yeah. But I mean, they just really, all that money will be spent. Where you take the 50% of the world's net worth is controlled by 85 people. If you give those guys another $100 billion, they're not going to spend one single penny of it. They might buy a few more businesses and fire a whole bunch of people to make it more profitable, but they're not interested in buying. What could you possibly buy? You've got everything. You've got private jets and houses all around the world, and I don't know. There's nothing left to buy.
Well, you know, to go back one quick step, I saw research back when George W. Bush, when he enacted the first, what was it, a tax rebate?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That was a pretty small amount of money.
Right.
But the reality was they could trace back to the start of the market recovering and doing well exactly to the week that those checks went out.
Yep.
All of a sudden, that started stimulating the economy.
Right.
And that was small amounts to everyone.
Like $500 or something.
Right.
Yeah. And no, absolutely.
So you're talking about 4,000 or 100,000 if the Fed would just give us the money instead of buying back the bonds.
Right. No, exactly.
We should start a movement to do that.
I think so. Well, yeah, when we come back, let's talk about how businesses are being impacted and how the big business is actually taking over from small businesses and the impact of that.
Let's do it. Welcome back. Thank you for listening. You're listening to the Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. Once again, if you would like to talk with us or you have a question for us, feel free to send us an email, dan@theportfoliodoctors.com or steve@theportfoliodoctors.com. I am Dan Osgood.
I'm Steve Beck.
And we compose the Portfolio Doctors.
Yeah, and we've been talking about this whole discrepancy between rich and poor and what that means. And the one place that really it has a massive impact, because not only has there been a big skew towards, you know, the rich getting richer and the poor not so much, and what that's having an economic impact on growth. But when you look at big business versus small business, it really is actually quite scary, because what happens is, in the past, small business typically is the engine of growth. because they're innovators. They come out and they hire people. They try to grow. A lot of them go out of business. But the larger business, they're spending their money on marketing and advertising, not necessarily employing.
Right. Yeah, because as the small business grows, they need to hire people to handle the capacity if it's going to be a successful business.
Yeah.
And that's where that growth comes from, where your IBMs, although IBM is laying people off,
yeah,
that's probably the more common thing you see with these large companies is they just are maintaining, and then suddenly that's not good enough, and they end up having to actually lay people off. So if anything, they could be subtracting from the workforce.
Correct, and a lot of times they'll acquire a small business and lay half the staff off just to keep the product, for example.
Right.
But, I mean, over the years, it's been proven that economic recovery and strength is actually what makes an economy grow. And so what you really want to see is you want to see these small business creating jobs, hiring people. But what's happened with all this Obamacare and with everything else, the tax structure and everything else that's happening, is it's making it more and more difficult for small businesses to operate. And it's making it easier and easier for big business. It's really no big deal if you're a big business to add a new employee, because Obamacare and those types of things, it's a rounding error for you. When you're a small business, you've got, let's say, 5 employees, you add 1 or 2 employees, and now you have to be burdened with Obamacare, you've got to be burdened with taxes, you've got to be burdened with everything else, not only that, but administrative issues and all the rest of it. It really starts to impact you, your decision as to whether you should hire or not.
And pieces of information are just on the federal level, not even counting like here in California.
Oh, no. Exactly.
The state impact, where they throw on their own number of layers on top of that.
I would say in my week, at least 5 to 10 hours a week is just administration, trying to keep compliant with everything that has to be done. And that's just, I mean, takes away from everything. But they showed, there's a chart here, which if you look really closely on your radio screen, you can there's a chart,
but not if you're driving.
Yeah, but there's a chart that's just showing the share of U.S. workers employed by small businesses. And if you go back to 1993, right, so 20 years ago, over 50% of people were employed by small businesses. Now 20 years later, we're down to just over 45%. So you've had a contraction of 5% from the small business to the big businesses. And that is really the biggest problem I see. You've got to stimulate growth. You've got to have innovation. I mean, I know a number of people who started small businesses. You for sure do too, Dan, where they start the small business, they go there, it's quick, it's nimble. You get something done. This is not working. Change gears. Let's do this way, okay? And I mean, it all happens within a week,
right?
You know, and then they sell to a big company, and they come and they tell you, I can't get anything done.
Well,
I've got to go to a committee, then I've got to go to a meeting, then I've got to present my plan, then I've got to do this. By the time we finally make the decision to actually go and do something, it's almost too late.
Right.
The market's closed, someone else has come up with the idea, and doesn't matter.
In the small business, you have a direct access typically to a decision maker, where you can present a case of, hey, if we do this, it'll work better, and say, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
Where in the big, like you're saying, it's almost like a small shot of our government.
I know.
In a big corporation, it really is, because how many new committees and task forces have been created over the last 6-8 years?
Oh, man, yeah.
The committee to oversee the committee that's overseeing the committee. It's like, are you kidding me? That's just get nothing done.
Yeah, but the problem is we've just seen the one committee they do need, which is the whole deficit budget or printing money and stopping them from spending. That's gone now.
Yeah, they definitely caved in.
So the committees that you need, you don't have, and then the committees you don't need, there's tons of.
Right.
But, I mean, this whole small business thing, until they somehow start changing regulation, and this, by the way, you can see that number moved over 20 years. You don't get this type of playing field to shift like it has. And I've never seen it more skewed in my life than it is right now. And it's getting more skewed every day with all these social handouts. And as you mentioned earlier, encouraging people to sit and do nothing rather than actually get out there and work is benefiting big business at the expense of all the little guys.
Right. Well, we joked about this before. But I saw one of the internet memes where it had a picture, I think, of a mountain lion. And it said, in every national park in the United States, there are signs that say, please do not feed the animals.
Yeah.
Because if you do, they will become dependent on that food and will stop fending for themselves.
Right.
And this is coming from the federal government, who is doing the same thing. And whether you like it or not, people are a variety of animal. And that's what's happening, is you're creating a system where there's almost no incentive to work harder.
Exactly.
Because, well, the government will just give me some money,
right,
and it'll take care of it. And it's an unfortunate situation, but it definitely seems to be the path we're on.
Yeah, I agreed. And until you can turn this playing field around, so it's encouraging growth, encouraging small businesses. But as I was saying earlier, these rules and regulations haven't just happened all this year. They've been slowly implementing these since like the 60s or 70s. It's taken 40, 50 years for us to get to this issue, to this bad of a place, and to unwind it. You basically need a proactive government that starts very slowly. And unfortunately, the governments that we've got, and it looks like the governments that we're going to get, are just more intent of doing more of the same and giving out more handouts. And at some point, it's a disaster.
It's definitely moving away from the politicians represent the citizens. It's becoming the politicians dictate what the citizens do.
Exactly.
And with the way our country was founded was there are our leaders that we appoint. They work for us, and that's really been shifting over the last 20, 30 years.
Well, just think, you've got some senators that have sat there for that length of time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you think they've got in touch with what's going on there?
They're absolutely useless. They know how to work through the political system and get whatever they want accomplished and get reelected. That's why I'm a big believer that there should be term limits, max 8 years, maybe even less for the senators and congressmen, and just none of this perpetual reelection. Let's get some new blood in there, people that are actually motivated to actually accomplish something, because this whole group of people, what have they accomplished? They are still on record as being the least productive group in the history of politicians.
Yeah.
Stick around. We will be back to set you straight and continue giving you the best, hopefully the best information you can get to making the best financial decisions to help your life towards retirement, in retirement, and further. Welcome back. Thank you for listening. You're listening to the Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. Once again, if you would like to talk with us or you have a question for us, feel free to send us an email, dan@theportfoliodoctors.com or steve@theportfoliodoctors.com. I am Dan Osgood.
I'm Steve Beck.
And we compose the Portfolio Doctors.
Yeah, and we've been talking about this whole discrepancy between rich and poor and what that means. And the one place that really it has a massive impact, because not only has there been a big skew towards, you know, the rich getting richer and the poor not so much, and what that's having an economic impact on growth. But when you look at big business versus small business, it really is actually quite scary, because what happens is, in the past, small business typically is the engine of growth, because
correct,
they're innovators. They come out and they hire people. They try to grow. A lot of them go out of business. But the larger business, they're spending their money on marketing and advertising, not necessarily employing.
Right. Yeah, because as the small business grows, they need to hire people to handle the capacity if it's going to be a successful business.
Yeah.
And that's where that growth comes from, where you're IBM's, although IBM is laying people off,
yeah,
that's probably the more common thing you see with these large companies.
Well, of course,
is they just are maintaining, and then suddenly that's not good enough, and they end up having to actually lay people off. So if anything, they could be subtracting from the workforce.
Correct, and a lot of times they'll acquire a small business and lay half the staff off just to keep the product, for example.
Right.
But, I mean, over the years, it's been proven that economic recovery and strength is actually what makes an economy grow. And so what you really want to see is you want to see these small business creating jobs, hiring people. But what's happened with all this Obamacare and with everything else, the tax structure and everything else that's happening, is it's making it more and more difficult for small businesses to operate. And it's making it easier and easier for big business. It's really no big deal if you're a big business to add a new employee, because Obamacare and those types of things, it just gets, it's a rounding error for you. When you're a small business, you've got, let's say, 5 employees, you add 1 or 2 employees, and now you have to be burdened with Obamacare, you've got to be burdened with taxes, you've got to be burdened with everything else, not only that, but administrative issues and all the rest of it. It really starts to impact you, your decision as to whether you should hire or not.
And that those pieces of information are just on the federal level, not even counting, like, here in California.
Oh, no. Exactly.
The state impact, where they throw on their own number of layers on top of that.
I would say in my week, at least 5 to 10 hours a week is just administration, trying to keep compliant with everything that has to be done. And that's just, I mean, it takes away from everything. But they showed, there's a chart here, which if you look really closely on your radio screen, you can, no. There's a chart
here. But not if you're driving.
Yeah, exactly right. But there's a chart that's just showing the share of U.S. workers employed by small businesses. And if you go back to 1993, right, so 20 years ago, over 50% of people were employed by small businesses. Now, 20 years later, we're down to just over 45%. So you've had a contraction of 5% from the small business to the big businesses. And that is really the biggest problem I see. You've got to stimulate growth. You've got to have innovation. I mean, I know a number of people who started small businesses. You sure do too, Dan. Mm-hmm. Where they start the small business, they go there. It's quick. It's nimble. You get something done. This is not working. Change gears. Let's do this way. Okay. And I mean, it all happens within a week.
Right.
You know. And then they sell to a big company. And they come and they tell you, I can't get anything done.
Well,
I've got to go to a committee, then I've got to go to a meeting, then I've got to present my plan, then I've got to do this. By the time we finally make the decision to actually go and do something, it's almost too late.
Right.
The market's closed, someone else has come up with the idea, and oh, well, it doesn't matter.
In the small business, you have a direct access typically to a decision maker where you can present a case of, hey, if we do this, it'll work better, and say, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
Where in the big, like you're saying, it's almost like a small shot of our government.
I know.
In a big corporation, it really is, because how many new committees and task forces have been created over the last 6-8 years?
Oh, man, yeah.
The committee to oversee the committee that's overseeing the committee. It's like, are you kidding me? That's just get nothing done.
Yeah, but the problem is we've just seen the one committee they do need, which is the whole deficit budget or printing money and stopping them from spending. That's gone now.
Yeah.
So the committees you don't have, and then the committees you don't need, there's tons of.
Right.
But, I mean, this whole small business thing, until they somehow start changing regulation, and this, by the way, you can see that number moved over 20 years. You don't get this type of playing field to shift like it has. And I've never seen it more skewed in my life than it is right now. And it's getting more skewed every day with all these social handouts. And as you mentioned earlier, encouraging people to sit and do nothing rather than actually get out there and work is benefiting big business at the expense of all the little guys.
Right. Well, we joked about this before. But I saw one of the internet memes where it had a picture, I think, of a mountain lion. And it said, in every national park in the United States, there are signs that say, please do not feed the animals.
Yeah.
Because if you do, they will become dependent on that food and will stop fending for themselves.
Right.
And this is coming from the federal government, who is doing the same thing. And whether you like it or not, people are a variety of animal. And that's what's happening, is you're creating a system where there's almost no incentive to work harder.
Exactly.
Because, well, the government will just give me some money,
right,
and it'll take care of it. And it's an unfortunate situation, but it definitely seems to be the path we're on.
Yeah, I agreed. And until you can turn this playing field around, so it's encouraging growth, encouraging small businesses. But as I was saying earlier, these rules and regulations haven't just happened all this year. They've been slowly implementing these since like the 60s or 70s. It's taken 40, 50 years for us to get to this issue, to this bad of a place, and to unwind it. You basically need a proactive government that starts very slowly. And unfortunately, the governments that we've got, and it looks like the governments that we're going to get, are just more intent of doing more of the same and giving out more handouts. And at some point, it's a disaster.
It's definitely moving away from the politicians represent the citizens, it's becoming the politicians dictate what the citizens do.
Exactly.
And with the way our country was founded was there are our leaders that we appoint. They work for us, and that's really been shifting over the last 20, 30 years.
Well, just think, you've got some senators that have sat there for that length of time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They are. Do you think they've got in touch with what's going on?
They're absolutely useless. They're just, they know how to work through the political system and get whatever they want accomplished and get reelected. That's why I'm a big believer that there should be term limits, max 8 years, maybe even less for the senators and congressmen, and just this none of this perpetual reelection. Let's get some new blood in there, people that are actually motivated to actually accomplish something, because this whole group of people, what have they accomplished? They are still on record as being the least productive group in the history of politicians.
Yeah.
But, well, stick around. We will be back to set you straight and continue giving you the best, hopefully the best information you can get to making the best financial decisions to help your life towards retirement, in retirement, and further.
You've been listening to The Portfolio Doctors on ESPN 1700. To schedule a financial health check, go to theportfoliodoctors.com. Or to speak with Dan Osgood, Steve Bick, or any guests on this program, call 858-764-7250. That's 858-764-7250, or go online at theportfoliodoctors.com. That's theportfoliodoctors.com.
The Portfolio Doctors are Dan Osgood and Stephen Bick, who are investment advisor representatives of their respective registered investment advisor firms, ACAS LLC and Cunningham Management Company LLC. The opinions expressed by the Portfolio Doctors and guests on this radio show are their own and do not reflect the opinions of this radio station. All statements and opinions expressed are based upon information considered reliable, although it should not be relied upon as such. Any statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information presented is for educational purposes only. Moreover, no listener should assume that any discussions or information presented serves as the recipient of or a substitute for personalized advice from ACAS LLC, Cunningham Management LLC, or from any other investment professional, and is not intended as an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. ACAS LLC and Cunningham Management LLC are not law or accounting firms, and no portion of this presentation should be interpreted as legal, accounting, or tax advice. Information expressed does not take into account your specific situation or objectives and is not intended as recommendations appropriate for any listener. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from a qualified tax, legal, or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation.